Colonel Wiggin, Reel 3. Colonel, we were talking about changes in signalling with the armoured cars. You had to use dispatch riders instead of horses, I think.
Yes, yes, of course. If you want to get a message back to your regiment headquarters, obviously, you know, you didn't want it to waste or lose a car, but it has to be messaged back by a car, so you attached... You had your dispatch rider attached to your troop, which of course was risky, because he was very vulnerable, really, because the armoured cars were, as always had been, always would be, right ahead of any other troops. And to have a sort of unarmoured chap on a motorbike was really, you know, a very risky procedure, so you never really knew whether your message was always going to get back. Because it wasn't so bad in those days, but in the days of modern aircraft, of course, they'd pick them off every time.
Did you use a flag system as well, did you, Rachel?
I think we used to use flags for signalling. If we wanted the chap to stop, or we wanted the chap to go to the right, or we wanted the chap to go to the left, we wave a different kind of flag. Of course, it was very primitive. I'm sure Boadicea probably did the same to her chariots, if you only remember. But it's very primitive indeed, you know.
When did you start to get wireless, then?
Now this, I honestly, without looking it up, I can't remember. We got them when we were at Tidworth, from the 30s onwards. We began to get wirelesses. First of all, there was a wireless from regimental headquarters to squadron headquarters. That was the first one. Then we got down to squadrons to the troop leader. And then, finally, by the beginning of the war, every car had a wireless. So you could not only talk to regimental headquarters, or your squadron headquarters, you could also talk to your other cars.
Did you train to use wireless?
Yes, I personally did not go on a wireless course myself, but I was regimental. I went on a regimental wireless course. We used to run our own courses, you know, for the very technical chaps to become instructors and higher powered. But then we had a Royal Corps signals officer and personnel attached, who ran what I call the high echelons of the wireless, probably regimental headquarters. You had six signals, because it was much more complicated. That was where they had to have more sets and more crew. But I never actually went on a wireless course with myself, but I learned how to work them, and I could work one. And we had to work it with the wars, otherwise we couldn't go to any. That took time.
Did you find that this was the signalling people, it worked well, did it? That
oh, yes, we had a signal officer, they were really 11 bazaars. Really. I mean, there they wore Royal Corps signal badges. They were part of our strength, and the officers, and they were a signal officer, he lived in the mess, and the men played games and represented the Mazars, football, if they were good enough, oh yes, they were integrated. And the same, of course, happened with the LAD, or the Light A Detachment, which was then the Royal Electrical Mechanical Engineers, the REME. And we had them attached to us, eventually. But this all took, this didn't happen in a day, you know.
Did you when you went out on manoeuvres and things, did you have, for each squadron, when you first started to have wireless, did you have one wireless for the squadron, did you, who then sent messages back?
Not every squadron had one either, but no, I think each, when we really got a full complement of cars, we had one wireless per troop. One per troop who would talk back to the regiment. But originally, we'd only have a squadron wireless which could talk back to regimental headquarters. Regimental headquarters to squadrons, or squadron to regimental headquarters. Then eventually, I think it moved forward. We had one wireless per troop which could talk back to squadron, and vice versa, squadron to troop. And eventually, every car had a wireless.
And you had in the car whoever had the wireless, they, you had special people.
No, not necessarily at all. No. We trained our own people. You see, they were there really to keep the sets in order. That way, the mechanics and probably work back at regimental headquarters, and you know where there was much more volume of traffic coming in and required a higher technical skill. Oh no, we trained. We, I mean, as we went along, and they helped train our. We trained our own operators. We had, you know, wireless operators, gunner operators, driver operators.
Who stayed and they specialised in that?
Yes. Well, no. Because eventually we did our best to every man should learn a bit of everything. Because in a war, see, if one got killed, there's no good having a chap who could only drive. You know, he had to, probably the operator had to go and drive. So we all had to learn, really, every man had to learn, of an armed guy, every man, eventually, with the aim was to learn each other's job. But of course, in the higher echelons, like the regimental quarters, where the traffic was much heavier, when they were like, with the adjutant and the colonel and everybody issued orders out to different squadrons, then you had to have a higher technical standard, I think.
The armoured car you had for most of the time you were in England before you went to Egypt was the Royals, wasn't it?
We also had this horrible armoured car called the Lanchester. It was a very big, unwieldy thing. I think we had that at Tittenworth as well. But I thought that was never pursued. They never pursued that in the army at all. In fact, they did away with it, I think, eventually. When, see, as you know, I personally went to the Northamptonshire Yeomanry in 1936. But we had armoured cars in Palestine and Egypt when I was in Egypt, and we had the old Rolls Royce. In fact, the regiment hadn't begun the war.
Now you liked those? You thought they were good, did you?
No, we thought they were death. But I mean, their engine was reliable. But they used the water they used was simply fantastic. You see, and being in the desert, I mean, I think any water you had to wash, and you used to wash it, and then you had to pour it back into the radiator of the armoured car. Or drink it. Oh no, they were unsuitable. I mean, they were, the engines were all right, but they couldn't go through the soft sand. They were out of date, you see. And then, of course, we got the Humber armored car, which was very good.
But in England, when you first became mechanised, it was mainly
the
Rolls
and the Lanchester.
Yeah. What was the main? You said they were heavy, the Lanchester. Was there any other? They were difficult to drive, were they?
Well, they were very unwieldy, you see. They took tremendous amount of, if you want to turn around a narrow road, I mean, it was just a nightmare, right, you see.
Well, you knock things down and all this.
Well, yes, well, there wasn't room, you see. I mean, you had to, you know, and especially in England, in those days, people didn't like having their farmers to knock down farm gates, you know. They went geared to what I call having their fences knocked down until 1939, and they didn't like much either.
Whereas with the Rolls, they were far more.
They were old-fashioned, you know. I mean, they were both old-fashioned, and the Rolls were terribly tricky to drive. I mean, I used to drive Rolls a tremendous amount, and you had a gear on the right-hand side. You changed gear, went through a gate, you know, and you didn't have proper seat. You just had a strap round your back. You wouldn't have seat driving like that. No, they were primitive, really. They were really, and of course, and the armour wouldn't have stopped a peanut, except a rifle bullet. Oh no, they were quite unsuitable to go to war with. I mean, they were antediluvian. But they did a wonderful job, because there was nothing else, so we had to.
What about mechanical problems? Did they break down much? This is when, in England, before you went out to Egypt?
I don't think they did. I think they were really, see, it was a Rolls engine, and they were very, very reliable, you see. But they were only going on the road. When you started to put them in the dust in the desert or cross country. Well, they weren't cross country vehicles. I mean, they were. And then as time went on, of course, the other armored car did get more cross country because they had better springing. I mean, modern sort of, you know, suspension and all that. And then we could go across cross country. I mean, nothing rough like a tank. But you could go across field things. The old Rolls really couldn't go anywhere except on the road.
If you broke down, how did you go about repairing? I mean, did you have a fitter's?
Oh, yes, I think every squadron had what they call a fitter's truck, you know, which had what I call spares in. Every squadron had a fitter's truck. So you hope for the best, and you sent back the special one and said, I want a new plug or something. And then, of course, we did eventually have what I call tactical to again, a thing called the LAD, the light aid attachment of the remit attached to us for doing what I call the heavy repairs. Because we hadn't got the kit. I mean, we couldn't lift the engine out of Rolls Royce. You had a chap with a proper crane or gear. And the regiment did have this chap. And I think eventually every squadron had one then, I think. They do their repairs. No, they call light repairs, you see. That's why it's called LAD, a light aid attachment. But I mean, anything heavy had to go back to, probably right away back to command workshops, because, you know, where they had to all the gear, because, you know, you couldn't just pick up a Rolls engine and check it out and pick up another one.
How did your sort of daily routine alter when you got back from Bovington, you know, and you started up again? Did the daily pattern change?
Yes. I mean, we worked. We trained in the. I think, as far as I remember, we used to train in the morning, normally, and then the afternoon. Of course, there were still classes going on. For, you know, it's in the early days, of course, classes. And the afternoon, we used to spend what they call maintenance. That was cleaning the car, oiling it up. And then, of course, as I think somebody else said, you know, at 4 o'clock, I think, you know, that the car was finished and put in the garage and locked up, and you didn't have to go and look at it at night because it couldn't run away. So I think the troops didn't really work so hard, to be honest, you know. But on the other hand, you know, it was all rather impersonal, you know, because one rather liked to go and see what sort of thing, really, you know, when you were used to that. But I think the men had a much easier time because it was probably 4 or 5 o'clock, unless anything very special on. The car was put in the garage were locked up, and you didn't have to go and look at it at night or walk around or, you know, at night. So the life in that way was quite different.
This garage thing you said in the afternoon, you had to supervise that, did you?
Yes, I think we did have to go there in the afternoons. I think one or two officers said they didn't go, but I don't think we went all of us. I think probably, untrue to say that all of us went every afternoon. I think the one probably officer per squadron went. It rather depended what was on, to be honest. If there'd been manoeuvres and we came back late, you know, or like that, well then of course you had to see in the cavalry, you had to see your armour car was all right, you had to see your men were all right, and you couldn't go off until you'd done that. But on an ordinary day, when you hadn't done, you know, anything out of the ordinary, I think there was probably one officer per squadron attended the afternoon. The others were went off.
Was your troop training then mainly orientated about mechanical things?
Sort of No. Troop training was never anything about mechanical. That was your instructional training on how the car. And your troop training was going on reconnaissances, reporting on motoring long distances, practicing getting your messages back, you know, how to deal with if you wanted to find out a bridge was held or said, I don't know. We did a lot of travelling, and we travelled rarely hundreds of miles all over England, training the troops, you know, once they'd been trained to drive and practicing.
But as far, you went on trips, did you?
Oh, yes, we went on. We went exercise. I remember guarding the River Severn, somewhere up by Worcester, Burford, all up there. We went, you know, right up to into Warwickshire, where we used to spend the night and camp, and then perhaps learn how to camp, how to look after themselves with their cookers, and sleep under the car if necessary. I don't know. All part of the training to learn how to live in an armoured car, because it was your home. See, you went so much further away than you did on a horse, you see. You could cover hundreds of miles a day, while a horse probably covered 20 miles a day at the most.
So this is an added dimension to armoured cars?
Oh, definitely, yes. It was I thought it was tremendous fun. I love my armoured cars. You know, once I got over the initial shock of being turned away my horses, they're happy in the armoured cars. I thought they were tremendous fun. And I think we all realised that they were going to be the arm of the future. And I've said before that we were lucky to get in on the ground floor.
And what about sort of when you went off on a trip like that? Did you take petrol lorries?
Oh, yes. Yes, you see. You had your transports, you see. And then, you see, you usually used to fill up at night, of course. I mean, and then the transport used to come up to where you were, you know. So you couldn't remember, armour car couldn't work at night. One, he didn't know where he was going probably, and two, he had to use headlights, because once he used headlights, he gave him exactly where he was. So at night, we all used to come back into what was called the Western Desert in the last war, into Lager. Now, like the Dutch commander did, you know, at night we were all back under one, all the squadrons to where to go there, and they let the regimental headquarters know where they were, and the petrol came up to them, and the food, you know, just as they did in the war.
So it's a big job for the adjutant and people.
Big job for the quartermaster, mm-hmm. You see, and there's another thing which, you see, the quartermaster used to be just responsible really for the men's clothing and, you know, and all that, and the horses' food. There he had to be responsible for water for the cars, petrol for the cars, rations for the men. It was entirely spares, you see, and then it got so much bigger that we used to have two quartermasters, one to look after what I call the food and the oil, and another called technical quartermaster, who was responsible for getting what I call the spare plugs, spare wheels, spare whatever, you know, the things you go inside engines have, you know. It was too much for one sort of branch, so every regiment soon and now has got two quartermasters, or quartermaster Q and a tactical one, quartermaster T, I think they call it.
And that developed from these days, did it?
Well, it had to, yes, but it got built up when the thing was entirely altered, you see. I mean, you had your armed cars hundreds of miles away, probably from the base, you see.
That was your sort of troop training, was it? And presumably that was your regimental training as well,
you used to start, say, in the spring or March with your troop training, then you had your squadron training, then you had your regimental training, then you probably had your brigade, and then you went on manoeuvres. Oh yes, you see, you gradually built up, and once the fellow learned to drive and learned how to work his troop, then the squadron leader had to train, he had to learn how to work four troops, and then the regiment command had to learn how to train three squadrons, and then the practice again. As you say, the quartermaster, he had to learn how to bring up the rations and the petrol and Uncle Tom Cobbley and all. And, you know, it was a new life.
Were you issued with any sort of tactical manual or anything about what you were to do on these training exercises?
We wrote the armoured car manual of training. Well, I was there, we did, the regiment did, Colonel Friend did, who took over after we mechanised, and did a very good job of it too. He and other people don't know, I mean, the adjutant and the other one is, and other people do know, and they wrote the first armoured car training manual.
He would what? Give you instructions about what he wanted you to do?
No, this is a book, this is issued by the War Office, and this is the War Office, and I knew that. I mean, this is a manual for all armoured car regiments. I mean, any other armoured car regiment, that's the 12th Lancers, and any other, like the New Hampshire Yeomanry, which I belong to, you know, it was our training manual. Instead of the infantry one, the infantry training manual is the armoured car training manual. I mean, it had nothing to do with the levels of how armoured cars should be used. Of course, we didn't really know. It was all trial and error, but we were the first to go, and we were the first to use it.
And he was able to write that as a result of the experiences he had in those early 30s?
Exactly. Couldn't be more right.
What do you think was some of the important things that came out then from that manual, the stuff that you had been doing? What were the major features of use of a armoured car?
Oh, gee. I think you better stop this for a minute, Chris. This was really how armoured car should be used in a war. Their role was entirely, really, 100% reconnaissance. You had to learn to fight for your information. You had to learn how to move your armoured cars along a road. What I call to keep well spaced out. Then this is a minor point. You know, cover from air. I don't know if you halted. You out came your things like camouflage nets and all those kind of things. You know, and that was all part of the training. It also included what happened. You know what you did. Get messages back, what to do if you broke down, what to do at night, it really covered the whole gambit of armoured car training, just like, you know, any other infantry training with infantry training, and cavalry training with cavalry training, when horsed.
You mentioned air there. Did you do any work with the Air Force at that
point? Oh, yes. Well, yes, of course. Remember, air was very scarce in those days. But we used to work with them in Egypt, of course, when we went to Palestine. But we didn't work very much with the air because, you see, we couldn't talk to them. I mean, if they wanted to send a message, they used to drop occasionally a message. Lucky if it fell anywhere near us in those days. But of course, eventually, when we went to Egypt, when we were employed in Egypt, we could talk to, necessarily, to talk to the aeroplanes, you see, in the air, that they can net in on our wavelength. Of course, it was quite another matter.
Did you, in that period before going to Egypt, did you do exercises with other arms, with infantry?
Oh, certainly, yes. We had divisional maneuvers. I think we had army maneuvers once. See, remember, I left myself in 36, but there were no, that's all right, because the regiment went aboard in 34. Oh, yes. We were used, of course, as core troops, normally. See, we were very much what I call blue-eyed boys in those days, you know. We were something new. People were interested in us. They didn't know, in fact, they didn't know what to do with us, really. In fact, we hardly knew what to do with ourselves. And that is really how we all came about and all learnt. See, this is a new arm. You see, now how are we going to use them? And I think we were used very successfully, and they found that we could do. I mean, we could get this information. And, of course, again, at times, if we were pretty cunning, we might find somebody's headquarters at crossroads not properly guarded, you know. We did used to shoot them up, didn't we?
You remember doing that, do you?
I remember shooting up some general. I'm not sure Prince Henry wasn't in it, too, at that time, because he was attached to the brigade staff.
So who was it?
Prince Henry, as he was, the Duke of Gloucester. We were a new idea, you see. We were new. People didn't know what we could do. It was great fun. And
the armoured corps was seen in those sort of exercises as being an offensive as well as reconnaissance?
Limited offensive, yes. I mean, he obviously couldn't go and attack anti-tank guns. But as no one knew what anti-tank gun looked like much in those days, there were some. But the only one we ever saw, but it was somebody waving red flags and said, I'm an anti-tank gun. It was a little difficult, wasn't it? Easier than when a chap said, I'm waving red flags, said, I'm a brigade of infantry. Well, that was even much harder.
And that used to happen, did it?
Oh, yes, it did. Of course, people hadn't got the weapons. Oh, I mean, it was very primitive. I sometimes wonder how hell we won the war. Nothing to do with it.
You went, when you did these big manoeuvres, that was with the Aldershot Command, was it?
Yeah, mainly Aldershot Command, yes, I think we did. I think, probably it was then, yes, and Western Command. Any command, you see, we were new. Everybody really wanted us, you see. Everybody wanted to handle us. Everybody thought, this is tremendous new arms, it's going to be fun. How can I use them? And so we used to go out a lot. And we did a lot of Aldershot Command, a lot of Western Command, because Aldershot, we went all over England, really.
Western Command up in...
In the old days, I think the headquarters was Chester, wasn't it, I think.
You'd go as far as that, did you?
I think we went, I think they came down to all, I think we went halfway, you see what I mean?
And what would you do on a big, great big exercise? You'd go out and do a reconnaissance, would you, for...
Oh, yes. The general said, I want to know whether the men are the bridges over the River Avon between Worcester and Tewkesbury Hill, you see. Have you seen any sign of any enemy in the area of one of these places? Well, Till's Head or Hesby, you know, these military places, you know. And if so, if you can, capture a prisoner and bring him back, you know. We were reconnaissance, right? There's entirely the role, really. It wasn't the fighting role, it never meant to be. I mean, they didn't say we didn't fight, because we had to fight much more in the war, of course, it was quite different. But we were still reconnaissance.
Did you at that time work at all with the tank corps, or what the tank corps were doing? Were you in touch with them at all?
Oh, yes, we used to fight against the tank corps, too, I can remember, do you know? Oh, yes. I can remember now maneuvers being sent out in a troop to find out whether there were any tanks in the area. Well, all you had to do was to stop in those days and listen, and you hear them about 20 miles off. Oh, yes, definitely. Oh, yes. But we never actually worked with the tank corps as such, because, see, that was a different role, you see. They couldn't go. They only went a few miles, and they broke down. I mean, not a few inefficiencies, but the tanks went fit. I mean, you know. They were, no, they were not like the modern tank, but that broke down anyway. So.
You remember doing this, do you remember?
Oh, I remember getting out of the tanks, certainly I can. Or I remember going to find out where the tanks were, myself, on a manoeuvre. Oh, yes.
And then what was done about that? Would you'd report back, and you weren't supposed to engage with the tank at all?
Oh, no, right? you got the hell out of it. Or you could watch them, you see. You could, remember, they could move much slower than you. On the other hand, they could go across country, so you didn't want to get yourself cut off. I mean, otherwise, see, if you got yourself cut off, you weren't doing your job, you see. Your job was to find out, you see. And then, of course, you could then went back to the army commander, if he wanted to bring up his guns and shell them, well, he could, you see, then. But you had to tell him where the boys were. That was your job.
So in that sense, it hadn't altered from horses?
No. Except you were much, information, you were much further ahead, you had, you know, and you could get them in half the time, or less than half the time.
Would you say overall, then, that the armoured car had improved, if you like, the effectiveness of the regiment from the horses? That they were a more effective weapon to work with?
Well, I think one remember that I never worked really, see, with those horses. I was only with the horses for about 1 year, and it was quite a different cup of tea, really, you see. I joined a year after I was turned to armoured cars, so I really only knew armoured cars, really. I did go on manoeuvres once on horses, and I enjoyed it tremendously. We had tremendous fun. We galloped wildly everywhere, but I don't think we did much good. Really, because it's a different game when you got to an armoured car, you know, you really felt you were doing something. I think, I loved it, that's it. But it wasn't so much fun, but it was great fun. I enjoyed it. I enjoyed manoeuvres, I love manoeuvres. You know, you got it on the country, and the troops enjoyed it too, and the men enjoyed it, and no doubt about it. They all in rank and file loved it. And I think, you know, we were then getting ourselves very efficient, and we were very efficient. If we didn't get efficient, we didn't get any leave, so no question. It's a very fair thing. We got lots of leave, but we had to be efficient, otherwise we didn't get our leave.
By efficiency, do you mean that mechanically efficient?
Or? Well, yes, your troop had to function. I mean, your cars went, I mean, if your cars broke down, or your men were ill-disciplined, you know, from that point of view, or if you did very badly on manoeuvres and did all...